Hi everybody, very welcome today to the second episode of the Elizabeth Bowen Society podcast. And with me today, I'm talking with Dr. Michael Waldron, who just last week gave the annual commemorative address at the annual memorial for Elizabeth Bowen. Hi Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you, Owen?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for talking to us, Michael. And just for people, just so they know, we're going to, at the end of this podcast, we have a recording of the entire address, which you made yourself, Michael. So well done. You can now be described as a sound engineer.
Well, I mean, I'm glad it worked.
Yeah, no, it's great to have a recording of it. And thanks for making it and sharing it with us as well. So can I ask, just how did it come about that you were asked to make the address this year?
I suppose I've been going to the addresses for many years, and it's funny. I think it stems from a moment I was in St. Colman's Church in Farahy, not for the address, but it was a gorgeous summer's day, and I was with a group of retired teachers. And they knew my interest in Bowen and my research, and they wanted, I suppose, as part of their own cultural and social activities, they wanted to do something on Bowen. So there we were in the church, and it was sweltering, and the insects were buzzing, and we just had a really lovely time. And I think Jane Ansley from Ansgrove was in attendance, and to my knowledge, it's she may have suggested me to Dr. Robert McCarthy, whom I had already met, mm-hmm. And he invited me last year. Little did we know, of course, what 2020 would look like, but it was great to be able to see it through.
Yeah. And obviously, presumably there was uncertainty running up to the event if it would go ahead or not. And obviously, we're lucky enough to be able to go ahead with it.
Yes, I mean, I suppose Robert was very patient and also very kind of on the ball in terms of knowing what was permissible under current Irish public health guidelines, mm-hmm. And the trustees, of course, were very careful as well. Thankfully, with the current guidelines, we were allowed to have, I think, up to 30 people in the church, socially distanced, yeah. And so on. So it was great to be able to do it, and that there was a lovely turnout.
Very good, yeah. And how did you decide to approach the address? How did you decide on the content for the address?
I suppose part of the content is born out of my own research interest in Bowen, which commenced actually in undergrad, but it was the focus of my PhD was Elizabeth Bowen and the visual. So that incorporated visual culture and visual art. And I thought that apart from a previous address by Hilary Pyle, which looked at a portrait of Bowen, that it had been a topic that hadn't really received much attention. So it was perhaps a new angle for the address. But I also, I suppose, wanted to populate it with very particular touchstones. So I wanted to give a sense of place, the place we were in as I was giving the address. I also wanted to give a sense of Bowen herself, how people perceived her, but also her own voice. And then a little bit of her biography, of course, and maybe an element of her biography that we hadn't explored much before. And then, I suppose, part of her own writing, her own creative and fiction. I suppose that seems like a lot for 15 minutes, but that's the approach, to bring that all together, but under the umbrella of Bowen and the visual arts.
Yeah, and I mean, people will hear now shortly that, you know, you did quote a section from her book Bowen's Court, actually, where she describes a Sunday morning in Farahy Churchyard. Was that an obvious choice for you to include?
Oh, well, for me, I knew that the weather was likely to be really good on Sunday, the 20th of September. And we really got lucky. It was a really beautiful day. And whenever I think of Farahy Church, of course, I think, and I say it in the address, I think of Bowen and her grave and all of those associations. But I think of that passage where she remembers Edwardian Ireland, the Ireland of her childhood, and in particular the Protestant community that made up the congregation in Farahy. And it's just such a beautifully composed scene, yeah. Very evocative of a particular time. And also, it was just a gorgeous nod that the vicar or reverend would allow insects ingress into the church. And if anyone has been there, will know the windows do allow creatures small to get in. And so it was I think. For me, anyway, it was an obvious choice to begin.
Yeah, I mean, I've forgotten. I mean, that's one of the, that kind of, those lines stuck out for me having read Bowen's Court. You know, you always kind of remember the little, as the boys in sailor suits and the girls in hats.
And in white muslin, yeah.
But actually, from the section you quote in the address, it actually is a, there's much more in those few sentences actually than just that. You know, it's very, very descriptive. And for in a talk on Bowen and the visual, I think it was really kind of apt. And also, as you said, the weather, I could just even see from the pictures that you shared with us as well, that it was really, that was the scene almost again, maybe minus the kids.
Essentially 120 years later or so. And what was, I think, quite interesting was that it really is almost a social history in a very sparing few sentences of how the different families interacted. Yeah. And I mean, I only just took a little portion from it, and I ended it on the pulpit. Yeah. And of course, anyone who gives the annual address must give it from the pulpit. Yeah. So it's quite a moment to be up there. I think it was just an apt way to begin, to scene set, and I suppose immerse ourselves in another time.
Yeah. And Michael, you know, you said that you've been to the address many times over the years, and I think this is it's 41 years since the first one happened in 1979. And obviously, you weren't around back then, but... have you, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, having attended a few of these addresses, you know, were you conscious of kind of the history that, well, I don't want to kind of be too overblown about the history of it, but like it is an event, right? Were you conscious of previous addresses as you were making yours?
Very much so. And I think an early draft of my address, I mean, I almost had gone without a script, knowing what I wanted to say. But I felt, no, this was the time not to ad lib, as it were. Mm-hmm. But I was very conscious in an early draft. I do name the people that kind of who have gone before. So Martin Mansera and Roy Foster and Victoria Glendinning and so on. I mean, big names either in Bowen studies or not. Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing about the address. It's not always a Bowen scholar. Sometimes it's a person who knew her. Yeah. Or, you know, there's always some other angle. But for me, I suppose, the first address I attended, I think, was about 11 years ago. And it was Maud Elman who gave the address in 2009. And that really stood out for me. Not least because I had read her book, The Shadow Across the Page, but also I think has such a beautiful articulation around Bowen and a very incisive mind. And that really stood out for me. And she was very, very kind and generous afterwards when I spoke with her. Others through the years, that I have been, Claire Wills also stands out, and I suppose spoke of that, the Bowen that we know from probably the war years. Of course, Mary Leland as well spoke some years ago. So I've been very lucky, I suppose, to join a wonderful group. And last year it was Heather Bryant, whom I unfortunately missed. But I know she will have spoken really, really beautifully.
Mm-hmm. No, it's great. Now, obviously, I think about 22 years ago now, the Farahy Addresses was published, which included a selection of them from the first one through to then. And obviously, we have another 20 years of them now. So, and I'm not sure that they haven't, I'm not sure, presumably people have records of their own addresses. But I'm not aware of any other having been recorded. Are you, in terms of audio recording or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. Possibly people have privately recorded them. I suppose I only recorded it this year because I, kind of on the lead up to it, there are a lot of requests, people who couldn't make it or for whatever reason. And I understand that, you know, in the current climate, not everyone is comfortable or able to be out and about. And so it was, I suppose, an experiment. I just put on my voice notes and hoped for the best. but it seems to have worked well. But I don't know. I hope that people down through the last 20 years or so have it documented in some way in print.
Yeah. Well, can you just describe briefly after the service, can you describe the service in addition to your address? What form does it take?
So I suppose the setup was very, very well executed. Mary Leland, who I mentioned as one of the trustees, greeted everyone as they approached the church. And in Ireland at the moment, you know, you take people's details for contact tracing and so on. Hand sanitizer was there. People wore their masks. I think Bowen very much would have had something to say about this time. Within the church itself, capacity was reduced. Some pews were cordoned off, and not all pews could be filled. So that meant that people were nicely spaced out. And the service itself took the form of an evensong, which was officiated by Dr. McCarthy, and the organ was played as well by Dr. Ian Sexton.
Okay.
But the full-throated singing that would usually occur was reduced just to the two of them. Yeah. So it was an unusual thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think everyone understood the importance of continuing the commemorations.
Yes.
Under, you know, the most careful circumstances.
Yeah.
And the address then comes towards the very, very end.
Yeah. And then presumably afterwards, people step outside to the grave to pay their respects.
Yes. So people gathered outside, obviously in their own groupings. Yeah. I think we all always have to be careful to stipulate how it was. But people were in their own little pods or did speak with each other. And I think most people made their way sort of individually or privately to the grave, which of course is a very, very short walk from the door of the church. Mm. I must say as well, there were beautiful flowers in the church on the day, which was a very, very lovely touch.
So Michael, just moving on a little bit, you work as a curator at the Crawford Art Gallery in Cork, and obviously Bowen is a big cultural influence in your life. Does your kind of interest in Bowen influence your work as a curator in any way?
Invariably, she does creep in. she has formed quite a strong presence in my career, not least in my previous career academically, but also even within within curation. So within the last, I would say, 12 months, I have had two exhibitions that have derived their titles from words she has written or spoken.
Very interesting.
So presently there's an exhibition called Lucid Abnormalities, which sort of paraphrases her her words in the preface to The Demon Lover, where she speaks of, I suppose, the wartime mood in London and that sense of lucid abnormality that was shared, you know, not knowing where one person ended and the next began. And I suppose she spoke so brilliantly to that strange time of wartime and Blitz London, that it seemed like an appropriate title for an exhibition that opened, I suppose, just after lockdown, but during a pandemic, which very few of us, I'm sure, have ever experienced in any way.
Yeah.
The other exhibition from last year was called Everything of That Time Might Soon End, which seems prescient now. And it specifically looked at the interwar years and collecting within that time. And that phrase is taken from an interview between Bowen and V.S. Naipaul for BBC's Bookstand in the 60s, which I thought was quite interesting because it again spoke to a time and spoke to a mood I was trying to connect with. But I have to be careful not to put Bowen in every single exhibition. but yeah, she certainly has loomed large in, I suppose, my own concept of different time periods. But also I think it's a testament to her that these things linger in my mind.
Yeah, of course.
You know, you might forget many other things, but there are certain things that just chime with you.
Yeah.
But they're the two.
Yeah, very good. So Michael, we're going to cut over now to the address. Thanks very much again for sharing it with us. I'm really glad that more than 30 people get to hear this. So, you know, it's really good that we're able to put it out there, and I hope people who do listen to it enjoy it. So here we have the Elizabeth Bowen commemorative address made at St. Coleman's Church, Farahy, last Sunday, the 20th of September, 2020, and the address was delivered by Dr. Michael Waldron.
I'd like to begin by thanking you all for being here today, especially in such uncertain times. And my sincere thanks to Robert McCarthy and the trustees for inviting me to deliver this year's annual address. Having spent most of my adult life reading and researching Elizabeth Bowen, there truly is no greater honour for a lover of her writing. And in speaking today, I'm also quite conscious of those who have spoken before me. I feel certain that Elizabeth Bowen herself would have had something much more profound to say about the times we are presently living through. Indeed, she might even have coined her wartime term of lucid abnormality for precisely now. It is perhaps a credit to her, however, that the power of her writing, that year after year, we can go to the well and bring up fresh thoughts and new readings of her life and work. Today, I wish to place her within the context of visual art, her relationships with artists, and how we might read a Bowen novel or short story anew. Always when I think of this church, my mind, of course, turns to Elizabeth Bowen and her husband, Alan Cameron, who rest opposite the entrance, and to Elizabeth's father, Henry Cole Bowen, alongside them. But I'm also mindful of less somber things. And in her family memoir, Bowen's Court, the author composes this delightful verbal sketch of this church and its congregation of over a century ago. So if you'll allow me to read it.
And on summer Sunday mornings at Farrahy Church, we had, in those days of King Edward, quite a parade. The little Olivers from Rockmills, the little Gateses from the other side of Kildarery, myself and the little Johnsons from Lisnagorneen. The sun winked in through the trees and the south windows on the pewfuls of little girls in white muslin dresses and starched white muslin hats, and of little boys in sailor suits. Parents, grandmothers, there was old Mrs. Oliver. Visitors, governesses, Protestant farmers, and packed at the back, the Protestant servants of all households composed the rest of the congregation. The organ was played either by Mrs. Oliver or by Mrs. Gates, and we all sang loud, confident Protestant hymns. The rector loved all insects and was said to encourage the ingress of wasps to church. He had a sharp sense of the sins of society, and sometimes he used to denounce us from the pulpit. Years later, Elizabeth's cook, Molly O'Brien, remembered that Bowen's Court had itself been a place of entertaining, particularly during Elizabeth's adulthood in the 1930s and again in the 1950s. Isn't it rather thrilling to think that less than 500 metres and the distance of time from here across the happy autumn fields, the Bowen's Court Library entertained writers Molly Keane, Iris Murdoch, Eddie Sackville-West and Virginia Woolf, and artists Henry Robertson Craig and Patrick Hennessy. In a letter written from Bowen's Court to the Canadian diplomat Charles Ritchie on the 4th of May 1957, Elizabeth wrote that the weather this week's been lovely, garden full of tulips. On Tuesday, Patrick Hennessy spent the day here and did some further alterations to that portrait of me. On Monday, May Sarton arrived from Boston. When we consider Patrick Hennessy, the artist, we think of his portrait, which is in the Crawford Art Gallery collection, and is presently, and quite fittingly, on loan to nearby Doneraile Court. Of course, this remarkable portrait was the subject of a previous annual address by Hilary Pyle, and so I will not linger over it here. However, as the curator Sean Cassan has noted, Elizabeth became an important figure in Hennessy's life, following the artist's return to Ireland in 1939. Their circle also included Lady Ursula and Major Stephen Vernon, and they were regular guests at the couple's homes at Bury and at Ferryfield near Kinsale. In the 1960s, Bowen would note that those two famous Dublin painters, Patrick Hennessy and H. Robertson Craig, came to entertain them. Elizabeth was no stranger to keeping the company of artists. They appear in the pages of her novels, stories and non-fiction, as well as in those of her own life. In the 1930s, Elizabeth wrote reviews of the Royal Academy summer exhibitions, and regularly attended other art shows, including the chaotic International Surrealist Exhibition of 1936, in which Salvador Dali wore and nearly suffocated in a diving suit. She attended these with her friend William Plomer. On her return visits to Ireland too, even during the emergency, she sought out artist friends and a circle of acquaintances. So in a journal entry from 1943, it might not be surprising that the White Stag artist, Basil Rackesy, remembered a meeting with Elizabeth at Dublin's Royal Hibernian Hotel. And I'll quote from his journal. "We were to meet in the Buttery, the hotel's fashionable cocktail bar, and I was awfully nervous. I was glad to find Miss Colley there and Miss Sylvia Cook-Collis to hang on to, but once we sat down and began to talk, I became entirely engrossed by Elizabeth Bowen, who was in some ways like Karen Stephen. But she was tall, beautifully dressed, and delightfully made up. Her fingernails were dark red and painted. She was indeed an Anglo-Irish woman, but with a sophistication that only Paris and the more cultured of the London intellectuals could give. We talked of art, of Duncan Grant and John, of Virginia Woolf and Vanessa Bell and Angelica. We talked of Bloomsbury and Soho, of Fitzroy Street and Square, of Number 8. It was an entrancing lunch hour." So the artist here relates something of Elizabeth's fluency of the London artistic scene and the captivating manner in which she conveys this. Aside from Vanessa Bell, Angelica Garnett and Duncan Grant, it is interesting to note Elizabeth's friendship in this passage with another artist, Sylvia Cook Collis, who, of course, spent much of her childhood at nearby Anne's Grove, and later her married life at Ballymacmoy House in Killavullen. Photographs attest to the fact that both Elizabeth and Seamus Murphy, the sculptor of her eventual headstone outside, attended Sylvia's exhibition openings. During her Dublin childhood, too, and throughout her life, Elizabeth was a very close friend of that great Irish modernist, Meinie Gellett. Both had been taught by Elizabeth Yeats as children, and Bowen recounted observing the evolution of Gellett's Attle horses at her studio from sketch to sketch as adults. Paying a visit to the studio of Jack B. Yeats, however, was not to be a success. She was afraid, Yeats noted, I'd expect her to buy a picture. So why was Elizabeth so drawn to artists, or vice versa, why were artists drawn to her? It may, of course, be a matter of personality, of overlapping circles, but a clue may also exist in her second novel, The Last September, in which Elizabeth frames the protagonist's dubious artistry through a quotation from Pippa Passes by Robert Browning. Beginning, I am a painter who cannot paint. The epigraph to Lois Farquhar's drawing books is a telling gesture towards an artistic crisis that Bowen herself knew well. Indeed, in the novel, Lois experiences a similar creative impasse to that faced by Elizabeth at the start of her writing life. In an interview with Larry Morrow for The Bell in 1942, she would note that, until I was just over 12 years of age, my ambition was to be an artist. That's to say, an artist with a pencil or a brush. I even kept on attending an art school until I was 20. Although the dates of her enrolment at the London County Council Central School of Arts and Crafts, now Central St Martin's, are somewhat unclear, it's most likely that her first term commenced on the 23rd of September 1918. Commuting from Lily Road in West Kensington, a typical day for Elizabeth would have consisted of morning and afternoon sessions, beginning at 10 a.m, breaking for lunch and continuing until 4:30. As a day student, she had a wide array of classes from which to choose, including general drawing and still life, drawing and painting from life, general and life modelling, book illustration and poster design, miniature and pastel painting, fashion drawing and embroidery. Which one did she choose? No records from this time now survive, so it's impossible to know which classes she took, but it seems likely that she favoured drawing and painting. Apart from her daily routine of practical classes and workshops, it is worth noting that Elizabeth may also have attended lectures by Selwyn Image, the school's aptly named professor of art history, including a rather pertinent one on the 10th of January 1919, The Relation of Art to Literature. Her time at art school was, however, not to be sustained for very long. At some point in early 1919, during her second term, Elizabeth reflected that I just got bored, or perhaps it was that my childish precociousness just died a natural death. But there it was, it suddenly dawned on me that, as an artist, I was finished. She would go on to say that her time spent at art school disillusioned me as to my drawing powers. I discovered myself to be bored and art school dunce. This could have, and actually did, represent a major creative crisis for Elizabeth, and she soon began writing under the influence of the wish to paint. Years later, she would assert that, it seems to me that often when I write, I'm trying to make words do the work of line and colour. I have the painter's sensitivity to light. Much, and perhaps the best, of my writing is verbal painting. Elizabeth's embrace of visual arts aesthetics can often be momentary rather than sustained. A case in point is her description of Lois's mother, Laura, in The Last September, as being indefinite definitely, like a tree shining, shaking away outlines, a bay, a poplar in wind and sunshine. Sublimated through poetic impression, in this painterly sketch of Laura's gleaming yet unsettled demeanour and her quiver of personality, the author relays the qualities of character by invoking the impressionist aesthetic. The references to poplars, the shifting effects of atmospheric conditions, and the sense of loose, restless forms recalls the work of Claude Monet. Through a form of ekphrasis, then, a verbal description of a work of visual art, Elizabeth represents her character as both capricious and modern. Published during the Age of Speed, her fourth novel, To the North, 1932, is characterised by a heady cocktail of tropes from another modernist movement, futurism. This can be seen in the treatment of the modern metropolis, the evocation of a new mode called aeropittura, or aeropainting, an aerial view, and her violent comment on passion through the fusion of speed and the machine. A prime example of this comes at the close of the novel, with the protagonist Emmeline Summers' ultimate body embodiment of the title, To the North. A car-bound sequence that commences in St. John's Wood in London and heads north to Baldock, rapidly dissolves into increasingly abstracted, painterly expression. Syntax loses clarity, but takes on something more evocative, as in this phrase. Petrol pumps, red and yellow, veins of all speed and dangerous, leapt giant into their lights. The author's prose here gains a restless, dynamic, and dizzying momentum that echoes the futurist paintings of Giacomo Balla. I fear that this is but the smallest of appetizers for what is in actuality a major aspect of Elizabeth Bowen's makeup, both in her life and in her literature. It has been my experience, and I'm sure of many others too, that a Bowen novel or short story invariably rewards rereading. New details appear, new resonances are forged. I hope that when you pick up one of her works, whether to read a passage, a few pages, or cover to cover, that you will be alert to how immensely visual her life and writing is. And if you perceive something to recall an impressionist's landscape, a surrealist's dream, or a futurist's need for speed, then you may well be right. Thank you.